First time I met Mickey, I was sitting on the front row with Kip Collins at the Georgia State Prepaid Convention down in Augusta. Never heard of her, never seen her before. And Kip and his wife and I were sitting there, and Mickey took the podium. And she started telling this story. I don't know if y'all know Kip or have ever heard him. He's got a pretty outrageous story. He leans over to me and he goes, "I can't believe this." I said, "What?" He says, "She's telling my story." And sure enough, she just knocked everybody out that night. She's got an incredible message of hope that she shares. And I've become a good friend of Mickey's over the years. This is my third time being honored, actually, to host Mickey and to hang out with her when she comes to Georgia. And you're in store for a real treat. I'd like to introduce my friend Mickey B.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Mickey, and I'm a real alcoholic. And I've been sober one day at a time since February 5th of 1987, and for that I'm truly grateful. My home group is the Hearn Happy Hour Group in Hearn, Texas, and I live in Bryan, Texas, where the men are men and the sheep run scared. And the women are cunning, baffling, and powerful. I love my home group. My home group is centered around the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We believe in strong sponsorship. We believe on extending the hand to the newcomer. When we have a newcomer come up and show themselves at our home group, if we don't hear from them again, we call on them. Imagine that. We go out and seek them out. We believe in the fellowship of Al-Anon, our sister program, and we have several times a year we have events where we include them in, because we believe the family that recovers together stays together. And so we believe this is a family illness. But we believe in the Big Book, and we have a strong sponsorship. We have old-timers in our meeting, and we love, I love my home group. It's the best home group in the world. And if you don't believe that about your home group, it's your move to make it the best home group in the world. So, I want to thank everyone for being here this morning, and I want to thank everyone who's responsible for me being here. What a privilege and an honor it is for me to be able to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Larry and Susan and Austin for picking me up at the airport. I've got to hang out with Larry and Austin several times before, and they are a treat and a joy. They make me laugh. You know, I love hanging around. I especially love those young guys, you know, there's just something about young guys. I just love them, and I always have. I don't think it's a defect of character. Just love them, and look how nice they look today. My gosh. And Larry's a great guy. I love hanging out with him. It's always great, and his beautiful girlfriend, Susan. We've had a wonderful weekend. It's just been a great fun. And the speakers have absolutely filled my heart and my soul. Bill kicked it off great on Friday night, getting to listen to Mary Pearl. Now, y'all heard Mary Pearl introduce me as the newest member of Al-Anon this weekend, and I've got to tell you why. Mary Pearl was standing next to me in the hall when some woman walked up to me, a strange woman walked up to me, and she said, "Are you the Al-Anon speaker or the AA?" And my mouth opened, and this voice said, "I'm the Al-Anon speaker." I don't know why, it just came out. I mean, I didn't premeditate it, I didn't plan it, it just rolled right off my tongue. I thought, man, if I'm getting well enough where I'm confused with being the Al-Anon speaker, what a deal, you know? So Mary Pearl just kind of looked at me and she said, "Then I'm your sponsor." So I think I don't know what I'm in for, but she's even assigned her hostess to take me back to the airport this afternoon. But it's been great, and Chris and I've got to spend some time together, and that's been incredible. You know, one of the things I love about going to conferences is you get to see old friends, but you get to meet new and exciting, wonderful people. And, you know, I can go anywhere in the world and go to an AA meeting and meet a friend. you know, meet a friend and be with friends. So it's just absolutely incredible. Your Southern hospitality is just great. I'm familiar with it. Being from Texas, I'm familiar with Southern hospitality, but also I feel real familiar and comfortable here. I was actually born in Augusta, Fort Gordon to be exactly, but I didn't stay here very long, and I got to Texas as soon as I could. I was kind of spread all over, went overseas and did all that deal, and I ended up back in Texas as a young girl, still preteen, and I was born into the family of alcoholism. My father was a raging, roaring, abusive alcoholic. But people always said, you know, he was the best guy in the world when he wasn't drinking. He was the true Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that it talks about in the big book. And I didn't understand any of that until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and began to understand my own illness. The thing that I remember very well is my mother, who has never taken a drink in her life. And my mother's been a hard-working, good woman. My mother's probably the best woman I know and my greatest hero in my life. But she has been so stricken by the disease of alcoholism because everyone in that family was, and we didn't know what the problem was. My mother could no longer take my father's abuse, and she told him to either quit drinking or leave. And when I was 10 years old, my father left. And for a long time, the whole family thought that he left because he didn't love us, because he chose alcohol over us. And I know today, understanding my own alcoholism, that my father left because he did love us. That was the most kind and loving thing he could do, was to walk out that door because he could not stop drinking. And I didn't understand that for many, 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 many years. There's one thing that it came, you know, my mother reacted to my father's alcoholism. We heard Mary Pearl talk about it. We hear that from the Al-Anon family groups, how Al-Anons react to the alcoholic's drinking. And I know, without a doubt, my peace and my grace came from the 11th step prayer with my mother and with my father. The prayer of St. Francis, when it talks about, Lord, help me to understand rather than be understood. You see, my selfishness and my self-centeredness, I always want everybody to understand me and where I'm coming from. But that prayer says, look at them. And when I began to look at them and what my mother had gone through her entire life, and when I began to understand my father and his alcoholism, I'm at peace today with both of them. And what a blessing, what a gift, what a miracle to be able to celebrate, to be at peace with that and put it at rest. I didn't start drinking until I was 12. It's kind of late nowadays. But there was a lot wrong with me long before I ever took that drink. Because I guess because I was born into the family of alcoholism, I think I was born restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, I came out of the chute that way. I was a rebel. I just have always been a rebel. I rebelled against everything. I was a rebel with a cause. I was a rebel without a cause. I was a rebel because, you know? I mean, that's just who I was. All the time in school and activities and whatever, I had to be a rebel. I had to be different than everybody else. I was a risk taker. I was an adrenaline junkie. I mean, I had to be doing something all the time to get things heated up and get things going. What I know today by working the 12 steps is I was never any good at getting positive attention, but I was real good at getting negative attention. And if you're a kid of my type, negative attention's better than no attention. And my God, I had to have some attention. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is our problem. And so that's what I had to do. I had to have that. It may be important. So anyway, I had to have that attention. I had to have it at all costs. And so I would do crazy and bizarre things. I started lying as soon as I could talk. I started stealing as soon as I could walk. I mean, I don't know why I was doing those things. I just had to do those. My sister was the one who was the good kid. She was the one who would get the A straight A's. And she was the one that was the cheerleader in high school and the class favorite and all those things. And while on Friday nights, while she was cheering the team on, I was in the parking lot stealing hubcaps, you know. I mean, that's just who I was. I started, as a young girl, I started hanging out and doing things that young girls didn't do. I started hanging out in tattoo parlors, and I started getting tattoos because young girls didn't do those things. I may have started a fad that's going on nowadays. We kind of talked about that yesterday. I may have started a fad. I don't know. But I started doing these things and getting these tattoos on my bodies because young girls didn't do that. So I had to do it. It was kind of like a dare thing, so I started doing that. But one of the things I never did is I never got any tattoos put on my breast. And there's a reason for that. As a young girl hanging around the tattoo parlor, I heard the story of a young woman who had a beautiful, delicate rosebud tattooed on her breast. And when she turned 75, it had become a long stem rose. Some things just never get out of your mind, you know? But I started getting these tattoos, and I started doing bizarre and wild, crazy things. I started hanging around people with fast cars and fast motorcycles and big, and I hung around with the older crowd. I started being able to sneak in the bars when I was a young girl, and I would sneak in the bars, and I started hustling pool as a young female. Young women didn't do these things. Young girls didn't do these things. And that's why it was enticing to me and it was exciting to me. And I was rebelling against all good things that young girls should do. Why? I don't know. I was bizarre and I was just crazy. But that's just who I was and that's what I was doing. Again, I didn't start drinking until I was 12. And it wasn't a big deal that this young, out-of-control kid was walking down the street in this small town in Texas, and the neighbor had his garage door open, and in the garage were these cases of Long Neck Miller beer. I mean, this guy could not have been an alcoholic because his beer was covered with dust and cobwebs, and I don't know why he had it in there. But we snuck in his garage, we stole some of this hot Long Neck Miller beer, went down to my friend's house, opened it up. The foam went everywhere. We sucked off that foam, and we drank some of that hot Long Neck Miller beer. Now, it didn't take long for us to reach that feeling of intoxication, weighing 65 or 70 pounds, however much you weigh when you're 12 years old. But it was instantly followed by nausea and vomiting, you know. We didn't have those skills that would come later on, you know, the skills of learning how to appropriately coat your stomach before you go out drinking, the skills of putting your finger down your throat to puke so you could go back and drink some more. We would learn that later on. Or the one that I love the best of learning how to put your foot on the floor to keep the room from spinning. We would learn those skills later on. But this night, we didn't have any of that, and we got really, really sick. And we go in my friend's house, and we wake up the next morning with that green complexion. And we look in the mirror, and my friend said to me, "My God, Mickey, I'm never going to do that again." And she never did. She quickly saw what the problem was. And the rest of our years in junior high and high school together, I never remember seeing her tie one on again. And I looked at her that same morning at 12 years of age with the same sincerity and said, "You're right." Because I was really sick. And I said, "I'm never going to do that again either." And I never did. I never drank hot Miller beer again. You see, alcohol did something for me in that brief period of intoxication that nothing had ever done before. It went down in there and it quieted that restlessness. It stilled that madness inside of me. And it made me okay in my own skin for the first time ever. It just stopped it for just a brief period of time. And that period was so elusive that for the next 20 years of my life, I would do whatever I could to recapture and experience that again. You know, the only problem is, Clancy talked so well about it, as well as the other speakers talked about it, is that I would overshoot the mark. You know, Billy talked about it, and Clancy talked about it, but I would overshoot that mark, and then bizarre and crazy things would end up happening to me. I'm the type of alcoholic that becomes disgustingly and dangerously antisocial when I'm doing these things. And I would go out and I started drinking at every available opportunity, and I would drink and then I would get in some kind of trouble. And I started going places. I started going to jail, you know, at a very young age. I think the first time I got arrested was 14. And back then, they just kind of slapped you on the wrist. They called your parents. And my mom was always real hard to get a hold of because my mom was always working. My mom, God love her, was always working because she had to support my sister and I. And, you know, they say there are no regrets, but I tell you today I really have some because I was really a rotten daughter. My mother would work sometimes 2 and 3 jobs at a time, and she never came home to a clean house or a cooked meal because I was never there. And today part of my amends is I try to be the best daughter to my mom that I possibly can be. And she's just a great woman. Anyway, I started at every opportunity experiencing that and drinking whenever I could. And I didn't understand any of the disease of alcoholism. I just knew I wasn't going to be like my father. I wasn't going to be like him. So I started drinking, and, you know, for a long time, Bill alluded to that Friday night, for a long time, I appeared to be in control. I could drink more than these football players and end up driving them home. And for a long time, I didn't understand that. I thought I was just getting cool, you know? I thought I was really cool. I thought I was really tough. And I started being able to develop this reputation for being able to handle my liquor, handle my alcohol. These guys were the ones with the problem. Look at them. They can't drink. They're drunk. They're throwing up. They're passed out. And I'm still walking and talking and dancing and having a good time. They can't handle it. They're the ones with the problem. But I didn't know I was developing alcoholism. And I had no clue and no idea. I started having those blackouts very young in my life. I would wake up or come to and not remember how I got there, not knowing what was going on, doing things. People would call up and they would do things and say, man, do you remember what you did last night? You did this and this. And I would have to come up with some excuse, or I would have to pretend that I knew what they were talking about and why I did what it was that I was doing, because I couldn't say, no, I don't remember. How could you say you don't remember what you did? You know, I would come up with these rationalizations and justifications for my behavior. One guy in my home group always says, rationalizations, justifications, masturbation. It's all the same, because when you do any one of them, you only screw yourself. And I did that all the time. You know, I would have to rationalize why I was doing what I was doing. And I just became different than everybody else. About the age of 14, I found better living through chemistry. I started doing these other funny things. I mean, I would start drinking. I would start getting crazy. I would lose my senses. And somebody would present something in front of me, and you bet I'll do it. I'm a daredevil. You know I'll do it. So I started smoking those funny cigarettes, and I started taking those pills. Some of those pills would make me want to paint a house without a ladder, you know, or sometimes lay in the front yard and watch the grass grow, you know. I mean, it didn't matter what I was doing. So I would take all these prescription pills. I would take trips and never leave the room. I would take these prescription pills. Of course, my name was never on the pill bottle, but I would take all these prescription pills. And it was kind of like I had that elbow disease. You put it in my hand, it goes right into my mouth. I don't know. It didn't matter what it was going to do, just make me different from where I am. And it was not uncommon to find me out in a cow pasture after a heavy rain. It just didn't matter. It didn't matter if it was going up, if it was going down, if it was going all around. And what I've come to understand about all of that, because I've done the 4-step, because I've worked the steps, I've done a 5th step with a sponsor. Thank God for these steps. You want to talk about celebrating the miracle? The miracle is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we're here to celebrate. We have a way of life that gives us the ability to go back and make sense of it all. And I went back, and I was able to go back and make sense of why I did the things that I did. I don't just put down the horrible things that I've done wrong. I understand why I did them. I know why I turned left when I should have turned right. Fear. Most of the time it was fear controlling my life. Resentment. The things that I did. And what I know and understand today is when I tell you I'm an alcoholic, my problem's not alcohol. And my problem's not those other outside issue things that we shouldn't talk about in here. My problem is living life sober. I don't do sober well. I don't know how to be sober. For me, sober is boring. Sober is depressing. When I'm sober, I am what the book says, restless, irritable, and discontent. Until I can once again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And those drinks make me do other bizarre and crazy things. I will do that. Do I want to do that? Do I want to end up where I end up? No, just take me away from where I am. The steps, the miracle that let me go back and look at my life to see some of the things that I did and why I did them. For example, being a young girl, being raised in the home I was raised. I know now, today, that all I ever wanted my whole entire life was to be loved and love someone else. That's what we all want. We are put on this earth to do that, to love someone else and be loved. And I didn't know how to do that. I had no examples of that in my life. I didn't know how to do that. But what I can tell you, with alcohol and that need inside of me, at the age of 16, I traded all that for sex. Wanting love and traded it for sex because I didn't know any other way. And what had happened for me is I ended up pregnant and not knowing what to do. Today, in this day and age, if you're 16 and pregnant, it's not a big deal. It's really not. But in 1972, in small town Texas, it was a big deal. I ended up going to Austin, stayed with my sister there who had moved out of the house and had gone to Austin. I ended up going to Austin. They were a little bit more liberal there. And I went there and I had this illegitimate child. On one hand, I cursed God for allowing this to happen to me. It wasn't until I did my fifth step that I realized it wasn't God that crawled in the back seat of that car. And on the other hand, I thanked God and was so grateful that God put a family in my life that said, "We will take your child and raise it as our own if you have no contact with this child." And I made that deal because I did what I thought was best for that child, but I was also doing what was best for me. And today I can say that. I never could say that before, but today I can say that. And it wasn't until I got that I did the steps, and when I got to my ninth step amends, that for years and years I could not wait until that child was 18 to find her. But when I found myself doing my ninth step amends, my amends was to leave that child alone, to leave her alone. And that was for me personally. But I ended up letting go of that after I'd gotten sober. But I had this child, and I came back to small town Texas not knowing how to deal with that kind of pain. I had no tools. I had no coping skills. I had no ability to deal with something that traumatic in my life. And neither did my mom. We did the best we could, but I didn't know how to deal with that. And I turned to the only thing that was sufficient for me at that time, which was alcohol. Because you see, I could take a few plugs off that bottle and I could walk out on that street and say, "I don't care what you think. I don't care what you say. You can't hurt me." But I'm an alcoholic. I have that built-in sixth sense. I'd walk out on that street and all you had to do was look at me and I knew what you were thinking. You see, I know today, again, by working the 12 steps, that no one had to say anything to me. I shamed and condemned myself to the pit of hell for what I had done, and no one had to say a word to me. Not a word. But alcohol became my constant companion to help me get through that pain, because I had no other way to deal with life on life's terms. My solution was to make a geographical cure. Somehow I ended up graduating high school. I'm a good test taker. I didn't go half the time, but I went in, took a test, and left, and graduated high school. And my solution was to go somewhere and move far, far away, where no one knows me, and I can start over. I can get away from this sordid past, and no one will know about that situation. And I can just put my past behind me and go on. I'm going to go somewhere, and I'm going to have a career, and I'm going to be successful, and things are going to be different now. I'll find me a good man, and I'll get married, and I'll have children to replace that child. And my life is going to be good, and things are going to be great. And I had wonderful intentions, but I had no plan of action. I had no ability to do those things. But I had good intentions, and I moved 500 miles away to a small town right outside of New Orleans, Louisiana, where they party 24/7. And that was not a good move for someone like me. I was there 2 whole weeks before I ended up in jail. And I'm thinking, how did this happen again? I'm snake bit, or, you know, God's punishing me, or, you know, something terrible. But why is this happening to me? I couldn't believe it. I couldn't realize that alcohol and those other things were doing the same thing for me in Louisiana that it did for me in Hearne, Texas. It took away the pain of the past. It took away the fear of the future. It made me okay in my own skin right then. But it still had the same consequences. And they just kept getting a little bit worse every time. So then my next plan B kicked in, and I ended up getting married. I married the guy I got busted with. That way he couldn't testify against me, and I couldn't testify against him. Made perfect sense to me. I mean, you got to have a reason to get married, right? So we took in sick together, and I tell you, I stayed down there in New Orleans for a long time, and ended up moving back to Texas in about around 1980. And I like to say moving because it sounds better than unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Moving sounds better. And by the time I came back to Texas, I had made a lot of really poor mistakes. And one of those mistakes is while I was down there, one night under the influence of alcohol, I let a friend put a needle in my arm. And when I came back to Texas, I was drinking on a daily basis from the time I got up to the time I went to bed. I was smoking those funny cigarettes. I was eating all those different pills. I was putting needles in my arms, and I was doing whatever I had to do to support that lifestyle. I did have some children in that marriage because I desperately wanted to fill that void in my heart. But, you know, you can't fill a void with other things. And what I know today, again, by working the 12 steps, is that all my life I had a God-sized hole. And I tried to fill that God-sized hole with many other things, material possessions, people, situations, circumstance. But there's only one thing you can fill a God-sized hole. But I didn't know that for a long, long time. I had these two beautiful children, and my son Micah will be 30 years old this month, and he served 10 years in yours and mine's United States Army, and I'm very proud of my son. He's doing very well. He's stationed at Fort Polk, Louisiana right now. He has orders to go to Iraq in October. So he missed the first time. He had orders to go one time, and I said, oh, God, please, please, please. He got a hernia. He couldn't go. I was like, yeah, this is great, you know. He said, Mom, I have a hernia. I was like, yes, that's wonderful, you know. But it looks like he's going to end up going anyway on this October. And I have a son, Monica, who's 26, and she lives in the same town I live, and she's the absolute joy of my life. I landed on the way from the airport over here to the hotel. She called me up out of the blue just to tell me that she loved me. You know, thank God I don't get what I deserve. Thank God. Because I'm a mother, but I'm an alcoholic mother. And those two don't mix. From the first time that my children were ever laid in my arms after their birth, when they took their first breath, and they were laid in my arms. There's nothing more that I wanted with my heart and my soul was to be a good mother to them, to protect them and love them and give them everything that they ever wanted and desired. But I'm an alcoholic, and those things just don't mix. You know, From that moment to this day, this second, if someone walked through that door and said, your life or your child, take my life. There's never been a question of that. I would give my life any moment for my child. But I could not stop drinking, and I could not stop doing those things that I was doing for my children. No matter how desperately I wanted, no matter how desperately I tried, no matter how many commitments and promises and resolutions I made, no matter how many decisions I made, I could not quit doing what I was doing. I don't believe that there's anything stronger than a mother's love for her child, except the disease of alcoholism. Because it took me from my children on a regular basis. I'm one of those alcoholic women that will go to the store for a loaf of bread and I don't come back for 3 days. Now, I don't intend to do that. I never intended to do that. But that's what happened every time. You see, I would go and I would come home and there were times I would be so tore down. I mean, just sick. I couldn't go on anymore. And I would come home and I would go to bed. And I had these two beautiful, precious, blonde-haired, gold-eyed children. And they would be in there with the washcloth cleaning their mama up. And they would say things to me like, Mama, if you don't go out and if you don't drink anymore, you won't get sick. And my God, I knew they were telling the truth. I knew they were right. And I would make those commitments and I would make those promises and I would say, you're right. And today I'm staying home. I'm not going to do this anymore. I knew that more than anyone, that I can't do this anymore. My soul would scream out to them how much I loved them and wanted to be with them. And I would make those promises of today we're going to watch a movie. We're going to go to the park. We're going to go play. We're gonna go to the circus. We're going to pop popcorn. And those children are always so resilient. They're always so forgiving. And they would buy it one more time. And they would go off in the other room. And Clancy described it perfectly last night. It's like the spring in your stomach. They go off in the other room and pretty soon they start to play. Because Mom means it this time. And they begin to play and the heat's off and things are going to be great. And pretty soon they get a little bit too loud. And then my hand would start shaking. And pretty soon I am a nervous wreck and I feel like I'm flying out of my skin. And the obsession that we have, if you are an alcoholic of my type, that you have, it's not like I rip through the house running and screaming that I've got to have a drink. It's much more the cunning, baffling, and powerful type. Because what it says to me is it says, you know, Mickey, if you take one drink to just take that edge off, you can go play with those kids. You can go in there and play with them and things will be all right. But just stop that shake. And I go and I take that one drink. And then I got to have another. And then, kids, I'll be back in a few minutes. I got to go to the store for a loaf of bread. And I left my children with people children didn't need to be left with. And my children heard things that no child should ever hear. And they saw things that no children should ever see. And they experienced things that no child should ever experience. Thank God I don't get what I deserve. Thank God. When I was 6 years sober, my daughter had become a young woman and had become an intimate in a relationship. And it's with her permission I share this with you today. Because it's been healing for both of us. But she came to me as she would begin to have problems with this young man that she would eventually marry. And the problem she was having was in relationships and with intimacy. And as she began to divulge the reasons, I thought I would absolutely die. When she was between the ages of 4 and 6 years old, while I was at the store getting a loaf of bread, my daughter would be repeatedly raped by the neighborhood 15-year-old boys because I wasn't there to take care of her. How do you make amends for something like that? What do you say? I apologize. I'm sorry. How do you make that right? You can't. Not even God can change the past. Not even God can change the past. My God, I thought I would absolutely go insane at 6 years sober. Thank God for the men and women, particularly the women in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Al-Anon, who rushed to our sides, who scooped us up and loved us through that, who directed us to do what we needed to do. And I got professional help from my daughter, professional help from myself. We got through that deal. And what we've decided is that my daughter made the decision to not be a victim in that deal. And with us together, we decided that the miracle is that love can conquer anything. That love and God's love would allow us to be together as mother and daughter. And thank God I don't get what I deserve. She is a neat, neat young woman, I tell you. Absolutely wonderful. And today she walks free from that. Free from that. But it was a long process for her, and it was certainly a long process for me. And things didn't happen overnight, because they don't here. They just don't happen overnight. If you're paranoid and you think they're out to get you, they are. And in 1986, I was arrested for a first-degree felony, punishable by up to 99 years in the penitentiary. Now, in Texas, you know, I was just saying I was hanging out with my pals, my buddies, my compadres, but in Texas, they call that organized crime. And they're not fond of some of the things that we were doing. You see, where I was at that point in my life, the things that I was doing and the things that I was involved in, I knew what was going to happen to me. I accepted the fact of where I was. I knew what happened to people like me. We certainly don't get dressed up in a Sunday morning and come down and spend it with beautiful people like you. People like me end up in a dumpster somewhere. We end up in prison for really long periods of time. We get what we deserve. We end up shot by other people like ourselves. We end up shot by police officers. We end up with a terrible demise, and bad things happen to people like us, and I had accepted that. There was a principle that came out in my fourth step. It talks about principles. And the principle that guided my life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous is, you made your bed, now lie in it. And you see, I had made my bed, and I lied in it. I lied in it so well and so comfortably that even though it was in a miserable existence, it was survival of the fittest, I was very comfortable there. It wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I learned I could change the sheets, you know? But I didn't know that then. People like me don't change. People like me, I saw what happened to people like me. We die daily. We overdose. But we die. We get locked up. We're institutionalized. We go crazy. We die. I knew what happened to people like me, so I did nothing to change. Did nothing to change. I was going to live as hard as I could, as fast as I could, as long as I did, go out probably in a blaze of glory, and that's what was going to happen to me. Things began to become different. I ended up going to jail and lost literally everything that I had. Everything that I had. And I came out of jail. I'm one of those alcoholics that gets in trouble when you're in trouble. We got anything like that here? So I ended up going back to jail, and I stayed held at no bond and stayed in jail for quite some time. And during that period of time, I heard about people that went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it looked good when you went to court. I know, I'm sure we don't have any of that trouble in this area, but I heard about that. And so when I got out of jail, I went to my plea bargain hearing, and they offered me 20 years in the penitentiary as my plea bargain. Now, I thought that was a little bit steep, so I decided to take it to the box. And the box is a trial by jury. And they said it was a jury of my peers, but I promise you there wasn't anybody there I would have hung out with. And so we ended up going to this jury trial, and to make a long story short, let me back up just a second and say that prior to going to that jury trial, I did make a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in that meeting just cocky and arrogant. I know that's hard to believe, but I walked in there cocky and arrogant and so full of hatred for society and how can these people do this to me? And I went in there and what you did, and I went in this very conservative AA meeting where people were dressed in really nice starched clothes, and I walked in there with all my gangster garb on, and when I walked in, you did what you always do. You welcomed me with open arms. I walked in and you said, come in, you know, and welcome me and said the things that you always say. You said, you're the most important person here tonight. And I said, well, hell, I know that, you know. It wasn't any shock to me. And you begin to explain to me about what it was like for you and what happened and what it's like for you today. And this one guy started to explain about how his drinking had gotten so bad that his life was miserable and his wife left him. And the pain of that was so great that he put the plug in the jug and he went to AA and his wife came back and his life is just great. And I'm thinking, God, what a wimp, you know? One wife, one time? I mean, come on, buddy. I said, I know some women that'll drink with you. You know, come party with us. And then there was this other chick that got up in the back, and she was so excited because she had been working at this part-time minimum wage job that AA found her, and that she had saved up enough money to get this used vehicle, and how exciting that was. And I was like, geez, well, whoop-de-doo, you know? And my criminal thinking was, pay money for a car, you know? It made no sense to me that she was talking about honest living and a day's pay for a day's wage, which made no sense to me at all. And I didn't hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't hear what you were talking about, and therefore I could not stay. I did use it, however, when I went to this trial, and that I had been going to AA meetings. And for whatever reason, I took the stand, swore to tell the truth and to God, and lied like a dog. I should have won an Oscar for my performance during that ordeal. But to make a long story short, I went through one of the most excruciating 3 or 4 days experience in my life, and they came back with a guilty verdict. And then they probably sentenced me to probably one of the worst things you can do to an alcoholic of my type. They gave me a 10-year probated sentence with intense supervision. I'm sorry, you have gotten the wrong deal here. You know, I was even so sick at that point in time, I was ready to go to the penitentiary. Now, I didn't want to go for 20 years, but a little bit shorter than that wouldn't have been too bad. And then I could have gotten out and go on my way. But wait, no, you're not going to be telling me what to do. You obviously have me confused with somebody else that will listen to whatever you're going to say. But that's not me, because I am not interested in what you have to tell me, because nobody's going to tell me what to do. And now by this time, I'm living in an abandoned house. I have absolutely nothing, and I'm worried about somebody telling me what to do. But that's beside the point. I mean, I was so angry at the world. I was so angry at everyone and everything that I was not willing to listen to anything. I left the courtroom that day furious. The judge gave me a couple of months to get my act together, he said. And then I better dot every I and cross every T, or I was going to prison for 10 years. And I left the courtroom just furious. And I went and did what I always knew how to do to make it go away one more time. You see, every time I went to jail, going to jail never did anything for me but really make me angry. And every time I went to jail, there were many times that I always was able to find God when I was in jail. I could find God, but my prayers were always the same in jail. It was always, get me out of this one. I'll never do it again. And there were many, many times when I meant that. I had a guy tell me that, I talked about that in a meeting the other day, and this guy said, God knew you were lying. I said, no, he didn't. You see, because I wasn't lying. I was telling the absolute, unadulterated truth when I said, I will never do this again, God. Just please get me out of here this time. And I meant that. Absolutely meant that without a shadow of a doubt. I will never do this again. And you see, one thing about God, though, is you got to remember, God is really old, and sometimes he's slow, but he always keeps his word, and he hears your prayer, and he eventually will get you out. And he got me; he would get me out, and they would call my name, and those doors would open, and I would go out on the street, but I always left God locked up in jail. Because until I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how to take God with me into my life. I didn't know how to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I didn't know how to say, here, God, you direct my life. I didn't know how to do that. I was so full of self-will, and I'm going to do what I want to do whenever I want to do it, and nobody's going to tell me, that I couldn't have heard God if he was standing on my shoulders screaming in my ear. It was all about me. And this day, I left that courtroom, and I went back to this abandoned house and did what I needed to do. People talk about when you hit bottom, there's only one way but up. I don't believe that. I hit bottom and I just kind of went side to side to side to side. I stayed there for quite a while. And you know, the day would come finally when this young man would come to me. As I mentioned before, I always liked those young men. I thought if you got them young enough, you could train them, you know? What I know about that today is that I always had to try to change you. I always had to control you. And today I don't have to do that, thank God. Thank God, because Alcoholics Anonymous works. But I had this one young man who was left in my life. And he was the young man that would end up saving my life. But I tell you, the price was high. He came to me this one night, and he said, you know, what are you going to do? He began to do some of this Al-Anon stuff on me. You know, he said, what are you going to do? He wasn't trying to fix me anymore. He was saying, what are you going to do? And I had no answer for him. And then he made a grave error as he began to point out the errors of my ways. He began to point out that I had lost everything that I had. I'm one of those alcoholics who's never satisfied with anything. I always have to have more, 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 more. It had to be a new motorcycle. It had to be new diamonds. It had to be not one car. They took three cars out of my driveway, not just one. So, you know, I would get something that if I have this, I'm going to be happy. And so I would do whatever I could to get that. And then pretty soon something else would catch my eye. And you know, if I had that, or a new boyfriend, or a new something all the time, had to be more, more, more. Today I know happiness is not having what you want, but wanting what you have. And what a freedom that is. And so I would go and I would get all this stuff, and I lost it all. I mean, they took it all, I lost it all. And he began to point out that I had lost everything that I had, including my children. And he pointed out that I was doing the same thing that put me there. Well, anytime anybody reminds me of my failures, I have got to get them out of my face. And so I began to do whatever I had to do to get him away from me. And finally, he just shrugged his shoulders and dropped his shoulders and said, I can't live like this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. And he started to walk out. And I cursed that young man like a dog, like a dog. Mary Pearl talked about that tongue, you know, and we slice people up. And you can never take that back. You can make amends, but you can never take back those words that come out of your mouth. How we need to be so conscious of what we say today. And thank God we have the ability with God's help and with God's power that we can stop it before it comes out. That is one of our promises. That is one of the results of working the steps, that we know what we're going to say before we say it. You know, if we're not responsible for us, who is? And I finally know that today. But I tore this young man up, and he finally left, and I cursed him as he left, and I went back in and had the ability to just turn it off and walk away and pretend like nothing ever happened. The next morning, the sun came up, and I went outside, and my life changed from that day to this. And I don't really know why, but it just did. When I went outside that morning, that young man's body was hanging from a tree limb with a rope around his neck, and he was dead. And I looked death in the face that morning. I looked death and I saw death for what it was. And when you have no God in your life, death can be very scary. And I started running. I started running. And I don't know for how many days that occurred, but it was several days that I just ran and ran and ran. And the miracle happened for me. The miracle that I believe has to happen for everybody before we are able to get this miracle that we're celebrating this weekend. And that miracle is surrender. Surrender. And how do we consciously surrender? If I could tell everybody how to surrender, man, I tell you, it would be something. But I don't know how we actually have to do that. It's an inside job. It's just an inside job. It doesn't matter what's going on out here. So many people say, well, you know, he's a high-bottom drunk or he's a low-bottom drunk. But that has nothing to do with that because that's all circumstances that are happening out here. Some people can lose everything and some people can lose absolutely nothing and be totally surrendered to their hopelessness and their helplessness. It's about what's going on in here. And I reached that point of desperation, of incomprehensible demoralization. And I know that today because I was driving around in this truck. I'll tell you about in a minute. I was driving around in this truck, and the miracle for me happened in a tear. A single tear. But that one tear opened a floodgate for years of uncried tears. Because, you see, I'm a tough broad. I don't cry for anything. But there were years of uncried tears that opened up that day. And I had to pull off the side of the road. And I know today that that act of surrender was answered immediately by God. And I know that now. Didn't know it then. I know it now because after a while I sat up and I looked around and I was outside that AA meeting I had been to many months before. And the miracle of it, it was 7:45 and people were walking in. There was a power greater than myself that absolutely pushed me out of that vehicle, up that sidewalk. I fell down. It was raining and I fell in the mud and literally crawled into what I call my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd love to tell you that people rushed to my side with a plate of donuts and a cup of coffee saying, "Let us help you up, you poor, precious child of God." But that's not what they did. What they did is they came and they looked down their long, skinny noses at me and they said, "Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? And have you had enough?" And my God, I had had enough. I just couldn't put one more foot in front of the other. I just couldn't take another step. I couldn't barely take another breath. You know, I just couldn't go on and I don't know why. I just had no more fight left. Thank God. Thank God. And they said, "Just come on and keep coming back." And they told me to sit down and I sat down and I don't remember anything that happened for a long time in many of those meetings. After several days, and I can't even put a time in there because I was so crazy, I remembered that I was supposed to see this probation officer because a couple of months had passed. So I go in and I see this probation officer, and again, my life would change from that day to this. She said, can you do this by yourself? And I said, "No, I can't. I'm sick." By then, just in a matter of a few days, with all that poison I had been putting in my body, I went cold turkey, and I tell you, I started getting sick. She tried every avenue she knew to get me into some form of medical treatment, and there was none available. Austin State Hospital was the closest thing, and they had a 3-month waiting list, and I was dying today. The judge had ordered me to 90 meetings in 90 days of Alcoholics Anonymous because he knew what worked. His father was one of the founding members of the Bryan Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in our area, and he knew it worked. And now I was court-ordered to do that. I was still a bit mentally like you do in your home group. And I literally shook violently. My hair fell out. My skin peeled. I had headaches. I was sick. I was nauseated. I would uncontrollably vomit on myself. And you cleaned me up, and you came over, and you said, you know, honey, if you don't put any more of this poison in your body, this too shall pass, and you never have to go through this again. And I dared to believe you. I just dared to believe you. And the miracle happened is after several weeks, it passed. And then I started sitting on the back row. And I'm pretty loud. I'm pretty tough. I started telling you about those times when I got away from the cops. I started telling you about those big deals I made out there on the street. I started telling you about how hip, slick, and cool I truly am. I started telling you about how tough I was out there and what a name and reputation I had. About that time, a guy named Charlie. Every group's got a Charlie. You know that 15-year sober guy? He's got an answer for everything. I found out later when they don't know the answer, they tell you, it's in the book. Charlie came back there to the back and he said, Mickey, why don't you fix your coffee and come sit up front with us? And I thought, well, they finally want to know what it's like out there on the street, you know? I'll go up there and tell them. So I fixed my coffee and I went and sat up front by Charlie. And he leaned over to me and said, sit here and shut up and listen. I'm the most important person in the meeting. How dare he talk to me like that? That I was so offended that I sat there and I shut up and I listened. And Charlie probably saved my life. One of many times in the next many years that he probably saved my life. But I sat there and I shut up and I listened as you spoon-fed me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. For the next 90 days, the only thing that you let me do was read How It Works. Because there were no cuss words in How It Works. I threw one in every now and then just to kind of liven that thing up, you know. God, talk about boring, you know. And that's all I was allowed to do. Charlie told me I didn't have anything to say because I didn't know how to talk. And until I could learn to talk, I couldn't share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard Johnny H. say one time that I was conversationally crippled, that I didn't know how to express myself without using certain colorful language. And until I could, I couldn't talk in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The old-timers in my group were really strict about that and still are today. And I'm thankful for that. I'm grateful for that. And so I sat up there and I read that How It Works. And then they started giving me these other odd assignments to do. I had to be the greeter at the door. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about me when I first got sober. You had to really want to get sober to come through that door when I was greeting it. I'm 5'10", and back then when I first got sober, I weighed about 115 pounds, and I thought I was looking good. Now, I was sunk in places you're not supposed to be sunk in, but by God, I thought I was something else. I wore these skin-tight blue jeans tucked in these knee-high leather boots with a brass tip on the end because I was cool. I wore this big black leather wallet in my back pocket with this dog chain that hung down to my knees. And hooked up here on my belt loop, because I was tough. I had this big wad of keys over here on my hip. Made a lot of noise when I walked. I mean, a big wad of keys. You heard me long before you ever saw me. Now, I was living in an abandoned house. My truck started with the screwdriver. But I got a big wad of keys over here on my hip. Because I'm important. I wore this big leather jacket with this fringe that hung down all over it. Because I was cool. I wore these black t-shirts with the arms cut out and the neck cut out. Because I was hot. I wore this black hat pulled down over my eyes, my little outlaw hat. And I had to wear these sunglasses in the AA meeting because my eyes were a little sensitive to that light. And every now and then I put on these gloves that had those fingers cut out in there, you know. And I'd look over those glasses and I'd glare at you. And I'd do that in the meeting. Now, if that's who you are, that's great. But that's not who I was, it's what I was. And what that was all about is keeping you out here. And combined with a filthy mouth, it was really good at keeping you at your distance away from me because I couldn't let you get too close. I couldn't let you get too close because I knew if you did, you were going to hurt. And I couldn't allow that to happen, so I kept you out here. And thank God, the old-timers in the group, people like Charlie, could see through that and see into that and allowed it, acted like it didn't bother them, and they let me come in and take my seat. Thank God. Thank God. Even my probation officer, when I wore T-shirts that had profanity and I would go sit in her office, she acted like she didn't even see it. Thank God. Thank God. And I went in, and it took a long time before I began to peel off those layers and find out who I was. And that happened when they started talking about, Charlie would say things like, you know, Mick, you need to get a sponsor and start working these steps. And I'd look around the room, and I'd see that young man with about 30 days by the coffee pot. And I'd say, you know, I bet he can keep me sober tonight. And Charlie would say, well, unfortunately, the men work with the men and the women work with the women. And I'd say, well, you know, I'm different, Charlie, you know, and I hate women. I hated women. You know, one of the things that kept me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time was Al-Anon. Because I used to love to go terrorize the Al-Anon women, you know. It was a spiritual experience. I'd be dressed up like I was, and on Tuesday night and Friday night at the First Methodist Church, they met up on the second floor. And I'd go stomping up those stairs, slinging that chain, rattling those keys, and I'd round the corner, and those Al-Anon women would scatter. And I'd kind of hiss at them, you know, and say, come on, you want some of this? And I don't think so. I didn't think so, because look at you. I'm tough, I'm big, I'm bad, and I'm not scared, and look at you, you are. Because I hated those women. I hated those, oh, those women made me just insane. Because they were so mousy. They were always so color coordinated. They always had on those cute little outfits, you know, that were matching. And their little pumps matched their little purse. And they always had their makeup on just right. And they had their hair fixed. And they were just so cute. I just hated them. They look just like I do now. But I hated them. I hated all women. And what I know today, because of the miracle we're celebrating here this weekend, the miracle of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, is I hated that part of myself. I didn't know what it was to be a woman. But you see, the old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous knew I needed to work with a woman. Because I can't learn what it is to be a woman from you guys. I mean, you guys are wonderful. You're cute. You make me laugh. My God, you're funny. You make me laugh and you make me happy and you make me smile. But I can't learn what it is to be a woman from you. I have to have women in the program. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous and the women in Al-Anon have taught me what it is to walk with the grace and dignity of a sober woman alcoholic. And I had to have the women in the program. The guys can pat me on the head, and they can pat me on the back, and they can give me some relief. But if I want recovery, I have to have the women. And I think that's great. And I was sitting in a meeting one time, and when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was driving this truck. I'll tell you about that truck right quick. I got this truck in a drug deal. I gave a guy half a gram of dope. He gave me this truck. I figured it out one day. That truck cost me $12.50, and I got ripped off. I mean, it was so bad. I told you when I got busted, they took everything I had. They took everything but this truck. And the only reason they didn't take this truck is they didn't want this truck, you know? It would have cost them more to get rid of it than it would to take it. So that's what I was left with this $12.50 truck that had been sunk in a tank of water. And it had been there for so long that the entire bottom had completely rusted out. I actually had to steal carpet and lay down in the floorboard to keep trash from the road from blowing up on me. The only place you could put your feet were on the pedals. That was it. It was one of those, it was an early 70s model Dodge Ram that used to have power steering. And you've got to envision all of this. This thing had holes all through it. I had put Bondo in it. It used to have power steering, and I'm coming down the road. I'm kind of psychotic going to my AA meeting, you know. People would jump out of the way when I come there. Mothers were pulling children out of the way. But here I'm coming to my AA meeting, and I would go, and then they would stand me by the door and say, greet people as they walk in. You had to really want to be sober to come through that door, you know. Willing to go to any lengths? Yeah, go over to that meeting where Mickey's at tonight. We'll see. And they would have me come into that meeting, and I would sit down in the meeting, and after that 90 days, I would start complaining about the state of my affairs and how things were. I'm driving a $12.50 truck. I'm living in an abandoned house. Things are horrible for me, you know. And they would say things to me like, get a job, you know. And so I would go to the meeting. I went to the noon meeting, and they said, are there any announcements? And I said, yes, I need a job. They said, well, what do you know how to do? And I said, weights and measures. Have some experience in sales, you know. Guy came up to me afterwards, and he says, you know, I can get you a job. It doesn't pay much. It's minimum wage, but, you know, it'll be some income. I said, well, I'll take it. So I went to work in this sweatshop drilling holes in marble sinks. And, you know, I'll never forget the day I came in after I got my first paycheck, and they passed that basket, and I put my dollar in that basket. I got a standing ovation from my home group. You know? My first honest dollar, and I knew what it was to do an honest day's work for honest day's pay. I had never experienced that before. I had no idea. And I tell you, I learned what it was to punch a time clock and be on time. And I learned the value of that. And I learned about being responsible. And I learned a lot of that because people told me to sit in that chair and sit down and shut up. And don't get up and mill around during the meeting. And if I would tell people, I'd say, but, you know, I got to go to the bathroom. And they'd say, well, pee in your pants. You can clean up later. And I learned the discipline of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned it the tough way. But that's what I needed. That's what I needed. Because when you're patting me on the back, telling me what a good job I'm doing, I don't hear you. But if you've hurt my feelings, you got my attention. You know, you just do. And I was complaining in this meeting one time, and this woman came up to me afterwards, and she said, Mickey, I want to tell you, you're full of shit. And turned around and walked off. Obviously, she wasn't at the meeting where they told me I was the most important person. And I went to tell her about it, and my mouth opened, and a voice like mine came out and said, will you be my sponsor? Now, I didn't want this woman to be my sponsor. Linda Kay had been a whack in the army. You know, I hear people all the time say, well, I've got to have somebody I can relate to. Well, if you can relate to them, they're probably as sick as you are. I could not relate to Linda Kay at all, except she told me how to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She knew the big book, and she knew the 12 steps. That's what I need to relate to. I need to know that I don't know and that I need to do these things. We had nothing in common, absolutely nothing in common. But I tell you what, that woman literally saved my life. I sat up a little straighter when I was around her. I paid attention, and I did what she said. She said, we're going to go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to start at the beginning, and we're going to go through. And she taught me how to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She showed me in the big book where the problem was. The problem, step one. She told me where the solution was, and we agnostics, that there's a power greater than myself, step two, that is my solution. At step three, she said, you're going to make a decision. You're either going to stay in the problem and keep drinking, or you're going to work the rest of the steps. That's the only choice you have. That's it. There's no more. That's the end. It's not to take a rocket scientist. We're not giving multiple choice here. That's it. You either keep drinking until you die, or you try and you work the steps. And I heard her. So I decided I was going to work the steps. I'd had nothing else going on. So I began to work the other steps. And she was one that you do three, immediately followed by four, immediately followed by five. And I'm telling you, it wasn't 10 years later when I got some relief. It was immediate. The results are in the book, immediately behind each step. You want to know if you've worked a step? You have the results. The results are right behind the steps. I began to be able to look the world in the eye. I could feel my nearness to my Creator. I knew that I was on the broad highway. These are the results in the book. They're in there. There are promises all through that book. I knew I was on the path. Not my path, the path. I knew I was in the miracle. Things started happening to me so fast, I couldn't believe that I was the same person anymore. Happened in a matter of months. These things were happening so fast. I couldn't believe it. And all I wanted was to just, originally I just wanted to stop that madness in my head. But things were being so good, I couldn't stand it. I ended up, I remember my sponsor early on telling me, she said, "Do you have a big book?" I said, "No." She said, "Do you have any money?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, steal one, you can make amends later." So I did. And part of my amends is I give big books out to a lot of people, and I do a lot of 12-step work, and I go to a lot of places. I do a lot of prison work, and I've been involved in doing that for 17 years now, and what a miracle and a blessing that is. And if you're not involved in service work or prison work, please do so, because things happen, and it will absolutely change and enhance your life. When I got through with my fifth step with my sponsor, I went into my... It talks about going for 1 hour and carefully consider the first 5 proposals. And I did that. And I went in, and during that time I had to go into the bathroom. And I came out and I saw my reflection in the mirror. And for the first time in my life, I saw who was looking back. You see, by doing that fourth and that fifth step, I could no longer blame anyone else. I finally was able to take responsibility for my own actions and keep other people out of it. And I saw what a selfish, self-centered, egotistical, inconsiderate human being I had been my entire life. Step 6 and 7 were like a light switch for me, going over and flipping on the light, because I knew what was wrong with me, and with God's help I could change. With the power of God, I can change. And I began to change. And things began to happen to me that were absolutely miraculous, absolutely incredible. And I went on to make my amends. Now, I made amends to my community, and because there were times I thought I was going to have to leave my community in order to get sober. And the old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous came to me and said, "If you leave this community, you will be running the rest of your life." They said, "You will stand here and you will look this community in the eye and you will pay back what you have done." And so I did that. And I became a volunteer within my community. I went back to school. I got some initials behind my name. And I became of service in my community as a professional and as a volunteer. And my community began to take notice. At 3.5 years, I went back. The judge called me back into his chambers. And at 3.5 years, he released me from the bondage of the state of Texas after having been convicted by a jury. But he said, "You are a changed person." And I couldn't believe it. I absolutely couldn't believe it. My probation officer said, "Take this a step further. Go a step further and do some more action." So I took some more action, not knowing that anything would happen. And I did that. I followed direction, what was laid out in front of me. And in 1994, I received a full pardon from the governor of the state of Texas, restoring my full civil rights. Now, that might not mean a whole lot to a lot of people, but I'm telling you, it meant a whole lot to me. There have been 3 times I've been called for jury duty. That's a privilege I should never have ever in my life. Not only do I have served on a jury, but I've been foreman of the jury. Because everybody else is going, "Oh, God, jury duty." I'm going, "Yeah, I'm doing jury duty." And what I can tell you about that today is it is a jury of my peers. I sat with a jury of my peers. Because I have God in my life today, and I know how to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I would love to tell you that every day is a holiday and every meal is a banquet, but that's not what life is about. In the past 18 years, I've had wonderful, miraculous things that have happened to me, but I've had a lot of painful experiences that have gone on as well. I've had people die in my life that I wish I could have taken their place for them. You know, I've had people that have died that I've not understood why I'm here and they're gone. I still don't understand why that happens, but it just does. And if I knew those answers, I would have no need for God. I would have no need for God. In 1994, I was feeling kind of tired, and even though I had been pardoned by the governor, things were going great. I was kind of tired. I went to the doctor. He said, "You have terminal cancer, and I'm giving you 8 months to a year to live." And I was like, oh, my God. I couldn't believe it. I was the most important person at the meeting. How can something so terrible be happening to someone so wonderful? And I ended up doing what we have to do, what we're taught. I surrendered to cancer. I went to MD Anderson, met a cute doctor up there, a young, cute doctor, who said, "You're not going to like what we're going to have to do, but I think I can save your life." And I said, "Go for it." You see, I'm not afraid of dying today because I have God in my life. But I am so hooked on life that I will do anything to stay here one more day with you. I will go through it, and I will do anything to stay here with you. I don't believe that there's some... I learned so many things during those 2 years of cancer. Number one, I learned that all my life I was a taker. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to give. In the 2 years of cancer, I had to learn how to receive, which is a deal to do. And I learned so much about the God working in my life. That there's not some God on some throne somewhere that says, "You know what? Mickey looks like she's doing okay. Let's flick a little cancer on her and see how she handles that." Because if I believe that were true for any reason, then God's my problem. And God can't be my problem and my solution at the same time. What is my choice going to be? What is my choice going to be? So I fought with everything I had. I did hands-on healing. I did Reiki. I went to Indian sweat lodges. I did radiation. I did surgery. I did chemo. You name it, I did it. What worked? It all worked. It all worked. Because people believed in that. They believed it worked. And there's power in what you believe. Absolute power. One more quick thing. I know I've been running out of time. Celebrate the miracle. The miracle is the 12 steps. The miracle is Alcoholics Anonymous, not me. I'm not the miracle. I'm such a small part of the miracle. The miracle is Alcoholics Anonymous. But know this, that once you become a part of the miracle, wonderful things are going to happen in your life. You will know how to get through tragedies. You will know how to handle failed relationships and job losses. My God, I've had them all. I have loved so passionately, it's pathetic, and I've felt the sting of lost love. But what I can tell you is that you will not have to walk through any of this alone. And you will have the experience of people before you that will tell you this is what you do to get through it. And you get through it. And what a deal, what a gift, what a gift. And the page will keep turning, and sometimes you feel it's selfish to ask for more. But God wants you to have everything. God wants you to have everything. Miracles continue to happen in my life. That pardon I got in 1994, didn't know why that happened. I know why today. I ended up getting laid off from a job I had. I worked my way up the ladder into middle management, and then some budget cuts came along, and I got laid off. Didn't know what was going on. Word got around that Mickey was without a job, and I got a call from a executive director who said, "I want you to come work for us." Today I work for Brazos County Adult Probation, where I was on probation. And I couldn't do that if I had not gotten that pardon. So everything that happens to us is of God. And when God's got something for you to do, nothing will be in your way. Absolutely nothing. Who would ever thought? I'm the first convicted felon to ever work for Brazos County Adult Probation. What a deal. What a deal. I have people come in my office all the time and sit across from me and say, "But you don't understand." Yeah. I don't know. One other quick thing is that, keep turning the pages, keep doing the work, keep going on those service works. God has plans for you. 3 years ago, I came home, and I get emails from people all over the country because I travel everywhere. And I came home one evening, and sat down to check my emails before I went to bed, and there was an email from a young lady named Kimberly who lives in Sugar Land, Texas, which is about 100 miles away from where I live. I met Kimberly, and I went in, and my daughter, I emailed her back and forth, and we talked on the phone, and then my daughter and I went to Sugar Land and went to Kimberly's house and met her. Kimberly's the daughter I gave up for adoption 30 years ago. Thank God I didn't get what I deserve. The miracles will continue to happen when you get out of the way and let God do what God has for you to do. And all I have to do is surrender. All I have to do is the next right thing. Keep doing what you know is good. Practice what you know is good. Quit doing what you know is wrong, and every day will get better. I'm probably not what I should be. I'm probably not what I could be. But thank God I'm not what I used to be.